Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com.
Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Simmery, and I am super excited for this episode, y'all. This is going to be really interesting. I have Katie Brennan with me, who is going to be talking to you about orgasms and about climax and about a whole bunch of interesting stuff. She is the director of One Taste Philly, the Philly location of an international organization, and they have a whole lot to offer you about thinking about orgasm and your whole approach to it. So welcome, Katie. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm great. It's really awesome to be with you tonight. Thank you.
Yeah, we've been trying to make this happen for like a hot minute. Yeah. I think I first talked to you, it was like at a human sexuality like meetup function mm-hmm. thing that was like a taboo of mm-hmm. all random places. And we're like, so what do you do in sex? And like we all have these completely weird stories. And there's always somebody who's like, domestic violence. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to talk about that.
We want to alchemize that, but like we included kind of all yeah. in our deal, but yeah.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like you're meeting other sexology
people.
Yeah,
the orgasm people are always fun to hang out with. Yeah. Like, reliable. We're reliably fun to hang out with.
So, yeah, okay. Out of sexuality people, orgasm people fun, who else is usually pretty good?
I think the BDSM people usually have good stories. You know?
Yeah. That's true. And they tend to be like, they tend to also enjoy other like physical pleasures, so their mm-hmm. food is usually pretty good. They tend to be like specific and a little bit.
I would dare say they tend to be brainy.
Okay. Yeah.
Like they tend to be a brainy lot.
Yeah.
That's good.
That makes sense because right? it's a thing that's largely occurring in your mind.
Yeah.
The experience of BDSM.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. It is.
Yeah.
I mean, we're so. You're going to make me geek out and be a science geek already.
Do it.
I think we're so at the tip of the iceberg of what we understand about orgasm in general. It's like a really, really exciting time. And actually, One Taste is really involved in that end of things, in terms of like mapping the brain in terms of orgasm and really understanding what's going on in there. You know, it'll be another bajillion, mazillion years, but it's so exciting to be at the start of that.
So for people who may not be like familiar already, what is One Taste? What do y'all do?
Yeah. We, primarily teach a partnered practice, a partnered meditation practice, aptly named orgasmic meditation, where, a stroker could be a man, often is, strokes the upper left quadrant of a woman's clit with like the amount of pressure that you might put on like a fuzzy on your eyelash. It's a really, really light, precise stroke. And what emerges out of that is a really feminine, I would say feminine model of orgasm. That's much less like the build, 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 linear peak drop model that I think a lot of us understand orgasm to be. And much more like a hilly country road. And the way we understand orgasm is like it's everything in that whole hilly country road. Like it's all the sensation, not just the really high notes, but everything in the whole symphony. So, yeah, it's a wellness practice, basically. You know, like yoga is a wellness practice. Like meditation is a wellness practice. It's a way to be in connection with other people in a really nourishing way.
So my first question.
Yeah.
When you say upper left.
Yeah.
So I'm like, is that stage left? Is that audience left?
It is her left. And for, you know, obviously there are anatomical variations in people, but like for a vast majority of women, that's where the highest concentration of nerve endings is in her clit.
Why specifically on the left?
I didn't make it that way. It just is that way. For most women, like there's a pinpoint. It literally feels like a pinpoint.
Okay.
Of like electricity and sensation and like that when you're dialed into that spot, you feel it. And the strokers feel it too. And again, we're just at the beginning of like researching why that is so. But like the stroker feels what she's feeling. You know, with time and with practice, I think that has a lot to do with how our limbic brains work. Our limbic system is like where feeling is registered in the body. Typically in just day-to-day cognitive stuff. Like there's stuff going on in your body, there's sensation going on in your body that's logged in your limbic system and then starts to file a report with your cortex, like the front part of your brain, the thinking part of your brain. And your cortex makes an analysis of that and says like, oh, like your palms are sweaty, your pupils are dilated, your heart's racing, you're nervous, for example, right? Mm-hmm. But back at the limbic system, like back at that level in the brain where the physical sensations are happening, that's where we're really talking to each other. So like when you hear about a mother holding an infant to her chest and the heartbeats start to synchronize, that's limbic system connection. Yeah, and that's what happens in orgasmic meditation, that kind of sync up. Such that the strokers really feel what the strokees are feeling. Like there's a whole symphony of sensation in their body as well.
I'm very curious about the actual process. So is this just like couples come to you and then it's just like the three of you are in the room, or is this like a thing that happens with like 30 other people, or like what's the situation?
So you can learn to own a variety of ways. There's public classes, basically, that most of the cities kind of around the world where One Taste is happening happen about once a month, once every 6 weeks, once every 2 months. So that's a great option for folks who aren't necessarily in a partnered romantic relationship to learn this practice, although we have couples in those classes as well. And you can also train privately. That's also a thing that you can do. If you don't feel like you've got a partner in your life, that class is probably honestly an easier access point into this practice, because then you'll have other folks who are, you know, in the same boat. And that's kind of the beauty of this practice, I think. Like it's so very deliberately contained. It's a 15-minute, repeatable, I know what the setup is going to be practice. And it strips off all that other stuff that we tend to pile onto our sex and relating, such that like I can have this practice under a big variety of circumstances, and I can have it any way I want it. Like if I just want to own with my romantic partner or whatever, like cool. If I want to own with a lot of people, fine. Like I can set up my practice to look anyway.
So for the folks that come into a class situation, is part of the appeal the fact that other people are there? I mean, like what separates this, because it seems to be, and you know, obviously this is coming from a place of ignorance, but like it seems to be sort of a combination yoga class / like Philly Jacks. Like
I don't know what Philly Jacks is.
Well, that's a good thing to bring up also. So Philly Jacks is like this organization.
Oh,
been
I do know what Philly Jacks.
Yeah, and for those who are not familiar, it's like a group masturbation. It's all men, it's like a 3 hour long thing that happens in a space, and you just come and you jerk off and with other dudes, and like you don't have to identify any particular way. Like you just go in there and. And just, you know, that's what you're there for, and that's what the point is. And like the fact that other people are there is part of the appeal for some folks. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious if you would consider it to be something like in any way comparable?
How about this? How about like, I think if we traced both of those down to the thing that we're actually hungry for in terms of human connection, I think there's probably some overlap there.
Okay.
Yeah. I think I have not been to Philly Jacks. so I don't know, but my sense is that what's different is that there's a very precise, what we call a container, around our practice. So there's a very precise technique. There's a very precise, like, step-by-step thing that's going to happen. That has it be that the Strokies Vigilance Center, so by Vigilance Center I mean, like, that little meerkat back in our reptilian brain that's like scanning the horizon, looking for threats, like that is so much stronger in women. That has to be that little meerkat can take a nap for 15 minutes and relax and chill. So like, I know what this practice is going to be. I don't know that I would know that. Okay. In that, so it's context, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and the other significant difference is that there is a lab after a class closes up that people can stay for or not, and have their first practice experience, but there's no touching in the class itself.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That would make a big difference.
Right? Significant.
Okay. So that's a significant difference. Yeah. So the very specific practice, the step by step things that you are discussing. What are the origins of this? Whose research are we utilizing? Where did this come from?
The origins are varied. I mean, you know, since the dawn of time, people have been stroking clitorises, right?
Hopefully.
Right?
Hopefully.
Like, I would think that cavemen, after discovering fire, like, found it beneficial to rub other things as well, right? Like, so it's deep, right? As far as the precise like format of this practice, it was really developed by Nicole Dedone, who's Wente's founder. She's got an awesome, awesome TED Talk that I'd recommend to your listeners, you know, heartily, where she really unpacks why this practice is the way it is. And so she developed a practice so that it would be repeatable, recreatable, digestible. Mm-hmm. Like there are probably some derivative practices that fed into Oming. But they're different in tone and they're very different in structure. And they're different in intent. The way we understand what's happening in an Om is completely co-created. So in other words, it can seem like because of... you know, how we've been conditioned around sex. It can seem like the stroker is giving something to the strokee, for example, right? And that's not how we understand what's happening. How we understand what's happening is that, like, these two things are creating a third thing. And that's what the orgasm is. So that's, you know, a really unique, distinct feature, I think, to Oming. Does that answer your question?
Sort of.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we've got other roots too. I think, like, you know, you could look back to like Sisyphus and say that, like, that is sort of a root for Oming, where the soldiers, you know, would come back from war and there were temple prostitutes there to literally, like, fuck the war out of them. That's a root for this practice as well. Like, this thing that we're deeply, deeply hungry for in terms of human connection.
And so you've mentioned stroker and strokey, and there seems to be sort of like gender specifics to that. So is it always a clit that gets...
It's always a clit, yeah.
Okay. And then, I mean, what if you don't have one? Like, what if you neither you nor your partner have one?
I'm glad you mentioned that. If neither you nor your partner have one, there's gay men who stroke pussy, really. And I think it speaks to this, like, and you'd have to ask them, but like my experience and my impression of what they've shared is that it's a place where they can touch in with a very different quality of orgasm that doesn't have to mean like anything about their sexuality or their relating or their, you know, any other facet of their sexuality. But like there's this deep thing that gets touched that like they don't necessarily have access to in other spots. It is, though, like an unapologetically asymmetrical practice.
Okay.
Like it definitely is. And I think that has it be... Like, because it's asymmetrical, I think it actually, if I can paint with some broad brushstrokes and some generalities, that often has it be that both hungers actually get fed.
Okay.
So I hope you'll indulge me with, like, I am going to make some, like, broad brushstroke generalities things. Mm-hmm. But if you think of, like, men have a lot of access to what we'd call direct orgasm.
What do you mean when you use that term?
I mean that, like, they can stimulate their genitals and feel climax. And it's not necessarily, like, rocket science there. Like, no. You know, like, it's certainly cases of male orgasmia and that kind of thing. Like, exist. That's a thing. And like you hear about it a lot more with women, right? Mm-hmm. Like perhaps less access to what we call sympathetic orgasm, which is like being in the field of somebody else who's alive and on in their sex. And so you know, they pull for things like strippers and porn and that kind of thing more, right? Perhaps. And with women, it can tend to be the opposite, right? So the thing that, and so they pull for things like vibrators, right? Like, so the thing that, oming kind of feeds both hungers in that way. Like, if the stroker is male, which it's certainly not exclusively, but often is the case, he gets to be in the field of somebody alive in their sex and opening in their sex and be in all that sensation. And that touches something for him that's like, that really longs to be nourished. And we have, I think, a lot of cultural stuff around shaming male hunger around sex in our culture. And, this can feed that without that shame, you know, or at least have you work through that shame. Yeah. And similarly for her, like she gets to just have that 15 minutes. I mean, what I'll speak for myself, like what shifted so much is just having 15 minutes of like pure attention on my sex and on my genitals and on my desire. Like the whole thing hinged on my desire. And so my whole life started to reorient around what I really wanted. And that showed up at first in my sex, but then started to reach out into all kinds of facets of my life that I never would have predicted. Like oming has really changed all of my relationships. Not just my intimate or sexual relationships, but like the way I, understand like the folks in my community, the folks that I work with, my family, like it's reconciled a lot of stuff for me just because I can have that access point, like that grappling hook, if you will, to my desire.
That's fascinating. I want to know more about that connection. So like if somebody comes to this practice and is learning how to do this specific thing, what beyond what happens in that 15 minutes are they going for? Like, so you have the experience, you have this, you know, one person is having this one, the other person is having this other experience, ultimately creating this third entity, as you mentioned. But what happens after they leave? Like what is the goal? What is hopefully going to come from it?
Well, it's a goalless practice.
Okay.
like meditation is a goalless practice.
Okay.
Some benefits include like surely getting, you know, if we even just look at it in a nuts and bolts hormonal brain chemistry perspective, like getting a regular dose of oxytocin in your system will radically change the way you see people around you, you know, like they're feel good hormones, and just having a regular dose of that your body generates, can really be very healing, transformative, shifting for a lot of people. I think, learning to get, for me, it was like learning to have access to my desire. This is going to sound a little, crazy. Maybe. I don't know.
Awesome.
Awesome. I came at this practice after a long career, and I still am a yoga teacher. There was a time in my yoga practice where I was in a pretty conservative yoga land and, where desire was like something that we overcame or conquered. And if I could do that, then I could have more freedom. And my experience has been more kind of in alignment with like what Ram Dass said. If it's not that we desire too little, it's not that we desire too much, it's that we don't desire enough. Hmm. So getting back in touch with what I wanted started to shift a lot of things in my life. And like there was a natural generosity that I experienced in my system that I probably didn't have access to before. And it had a lot to do with having the somatic experience, like in my body of 15 minutes, like no matter what, I could have it like I wanted it. And that started to maybe rewire that reflex that I think a lot of us have where like something's wrong and I got to fix it. Something's wrong and I got to fix it. Something's wrong and I got to fix it. Like to literally have the experience of like, something's right. I can just ask for what I want. I can, you know, so having that kind of access to desire, I think is really shifting for people.
What brought you to One Taste in the first place?
That's a good question. I a little bit stumbled in off the street. You know, don't the best things happen in our life by accident? My boyfriend, my partner, had heard about One Taste. We were out in, back then, One Taste was just based in San Francisco. We had been exploring a lot of like sexuality practices and that kind of thing. A lot of which honestly, like left me, like something was shifting energetically in my system, but I couldn't hold it. So it left me a little scrambly inside. There was a lot of like, I mean, looking back on it now, I can say that we were just like dumping a lot of energy, you know, but there was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of conflict. There was a lot of like, I was out in San Francisco for one of my cousin's weddings, and we really just went to go check out the center. And we had a private training actually with two of Wednesday's senior faculty, the folks that have really been at it the longest. And it was amazing in that, like, it was really different than a lot of other practices that I had touched in that spot where it's like it all hinged on my desire, it all hinged on what I wanted, and I had to start navigating what that was. So we went back to Philly, and I just kind of kept practicing. We just kind of kept practicing with this practice, and I noticed those things in my life that were starting to shift. Then about a year later, I saw that they were offering up a coaching program, and I was a little yoga teacher, and I didn't know how I was going to do it. And then, like, right before the program started, literally like 2 weeks before the program started, they offered up one scholarship. And I snagged it. And I spent the next year just deeply, deeply immersing in this work and deeply immersing in my orgasm. And watching my life start to reorient. And then right around that time when that program closed out, that's when One Taste was launching out of San Francisco, really around the world. And so they sent me off to start Philadelphia and start the community here in Philadelphia. Now we're in New York and Copenhagen and London and Paris and Vancouver and South Africa and Sydney and Melbourne. Like, it's just wild to watch this thing kind of spread out and like this power grid kind of light up around the world. And I think it does that because it does speak to that fundamental thing that we're really hungry for, which is connection.
So what is the trajectory? Like, is this going to end up in every city? Like, is this what?
I think it will.
Yeah.
I know that sounds like a bold statement because, like, we have all kinds of cultural stuff to navigate, right? Like, you know, we're not quite hitting up Beijing just yet, right? Like, because there's all kinds of stuff to navigate. And, when Nicole Dadon started One Taste, her vision was always that we could say yoga, meditation, and orgasm without dropping that third thing. Right. So it wasn't like yoga, meditation and I think what we stand as permission for people to have, like that connection for people to have that, to be alive in their body and be alive in their sex is universal. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And I'm curious how this translates. Like, cross-culturally, like,
yeah.
How will this go to the Middle East?
Yeah.
Like, right? how is this applicable? I mean, you're going to find lots of people in the United States who are resistant. Like, in your experience, when people come in, are they already super open? Like, that's what gets them there in the first place?
No,
like,
most people when they come in, like, are the, you know... Well, I mean, there's lube, right? Like, we have more introductory sort of events where, like, everything's clothes on, hands off, like, we're just talking, and we're touching on these various facets of orgasm. And then a little deeper in, there's this learning the practice itself, right? And in my experience, most people come to those classes, nervous and apprehensive. I mean, this is really charged core stuff. And, we design the course in such a way that as they work through the day, they touch in, one, on their desire, and two, on that deeply human universal thing, such that when the class closes up, like, they feel really deeply connected to their classmates. I mean, that's really our aim. and feel like the desire to have that thing touched is stronger than the nervousness and the apprehension of the, you know, like I sit down in front of a class full of, you know, new folks learning to ohm, and like I could just see writ large across their forehead, like, when will I take my pants off and how will I survive this? Right? You know, and then through the course of the day, like we start to just navigate all of that, right? Such that it feels comfortable and good and saturating when it's time.
I want to know about when it doesn't go right. Like, I want to know when people freak out. I want to know about times when someone in the room brings a destructive or distracting energy. What do you do about that?
We absorb it, alchemize it, and get to the thing that's human and universal. I mean, really, like, I mean, I'll speak for myself. Like, I came at this practice with a tremendous amount of trauma back there, a tremendous amount of sexual trauma. In my background, and I had to navigate through all of that, and it wasn't always at all pretty, right? So as I started to navigate through that, I got to a place where it was like I again got that like somatic, visceral, experiential knowledge in my system that my orgasm and my sex came from me and not at me. And it's not instantaneous. Like, it's not going to happen in a day, right? But it's like you can take this one little green leaf of something that is, like, you get to what people want, basically, right? So, like, what we might call distracting energy or whatever, it's just, like, compensating around that deep hunger for connection, right? We do all kinds of wacky compensatory stuff. You know, I think we're all in some way addicted to creating situations where we're separate from one another because the sensation of connection, like we haven't learned to hold it. And so, whatever, we do wacky things. You know, if you can get under the wacky stuff into the thing that we're actually deeply hungry for, like it sort of self-resolves, you know, it hasn't been my experience that there's been a lot of like major unshiftable wackiness. Like there's all kinds of like surface level wackiness and then you get under that thing. And fortunately, like the practice itself is powerful enough to get under that thing. Often we try to create shift in our life and we don't have the heat or power to do it. Like we're talking in January where I think you teach spinning and stuff too, right? Like you see that wave of New Year's resolutions and then that wave of like, where did everybody go? Right? So we want to create the shift in our life and then we don't do what's necessary to have the power in our system to create that shift in our life. So like we might have like wacky behavior patterns, for example, that other people would call like distracting or wrong or little. And you get that heat in your system that you can start to shift those patterns and start to hold more connection in your life.
Yeah. So this connectedness, is it, how is it going to manifest in the rest of your sex life? I mean, is it?
Only in every possible location.
Okay. Because like it sounds, you know, because on one hand, you've got this compartmentalized thing that exists in this container that has this very specific time frame and that it's goalless, right?
But your only goal is really to feel what's happening.
So is that something that you do and then you fuck? Or is that just something you do and then there's fucking other times
Maybe, or not, you know? Like, we really recommend that people, especially couples, don't use this practice as foreplay. It might seem great that one time, right? And then the next time that we get into that container, we get into that practice, she's going to be going, what am I going to owe for this? La, 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 la. He's going to be going, well, we fucked last time and now we didn't fuck this time. And blah, 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 and what does it mean? And, la, 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 and when am I going to get mine? Like, it creates all this extra layer of interpretation and stuff that has it be that we're not quite as plugged into just that very simple level of physical connection without all the story on top of it. Right. So like, that's true, right? Like hold the container of the practice because that's what has it be that it's repeatable and it's touchable. Like I can have an ohm with my partner when we're fighting. I can have an ohm with my partner when I'm turned on. I can have an ohm with my partner when I'm depressed. It has it be that I can touch in with this practice in any state really. I don't have to be any particular like way to have this thing work. And like that said, right, like my experience has been that my sex has totally changed as a result of umming because I can feel so much more. We have a tendency to, I think, our conditioning around our sex is maybe to pile on a whole bunch of stuff like vibrators, like porn, like lingerie, like la 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 la, in an effort to create, like jack up the sensation. And really, all we really need to do is beef up our attention. So when we strip all of that stuff away, you know, you might even strip away like needing to be in a relationship with the person or not, like whatever, like whatever's right for you. But when we strip all of that stuff away and we just get to that very primary physical sensation and that very primary physical thing that shifts us without all the stuff of what it might mean, that has it be that then when you go and approach your sex or whatever, you've got access to all those locations simply because your attention is that much higher. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So like the completely offensive way to put it is so that you're like on ecstasy all the time.
I mean, you feel all of it. You feel all the highs and you feel all the lows. Right? Like, this ain't gonna work you. This stuff is potent. Like, you don't feel all of it. Yeah. So, maybe a little more like acid? I don't know.
Now I want to, as a result of this, come up with what sexual act is what drug. I want to play that game. And I don't know how many actually apply.
I can't go down this road with you.
Which one's cocaine? Which one's a three-way? Which one is Prozac like?
But like, you know, if you think about it, we're all... I thought Nicole Potter put it brilliantly in her book. She's like, we're like that deaf guy that turns the TV up to like level 43 until the dog's hiding under the bed in our sex lives, right? Like, we just beef up more and more and more and more sensation trying to get this itch scratched. And like, really what we need to do is beef up our attention. Like, really start to pay attention to like what things feel like and really get subtle. Really get granular. Like if you've watched like a brilliant stage actor, they don't necessarily convey a lot of anything by yelling really loud, right? But like that really potent whisper. Yeah, it's that, right?
I'm also curious about the role of like eye contact during this.
There is none. Because of the nature of the position in the stroke, the stroker keeps their full attention on her pussy.
Huh?
Yeah. There's no eye gazey woo woo la la la. Not there's anything wrong with that. That's cool. But like, really, the physical body is giving the stroker all the information they need.
Huh.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, there's like so much to process because like, I don't know, I keep thinking about all these different like intimacy building things that really like bridge the gap of like all the facade that we put up and, you know,
there's a layer of interpretation with all that stuff too. I mean, I think that's true. And invariably, like if I'm in the receiver in one of those exercises and like, I am interpreting your facial expression to mean X, like that's happening at the level of my cortex in my brain. Again, like we're dialing it back to the level of the limbic system where it's just physical sensation, right? Without that level of analysis, without that level of interpretation or what it means. And that's why it's a meditation practice. It's like you fix, just like in any meditation where you fix your attention to a thing and don't like decide what it means, decide if it's doing right. Although all that scramble will probably happen in your mind. I mean, in my meditation, it definitely does because minds do that. When that happens, my mission in a meditation practice is to come back to the thing, right? Here, the thing is the point of connection between fingertip and clit. And just keep coming back to that. Just keep coming back to that to not analyze, decide what it means. Blah, 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 blah. Just feel. Just feel. And like, yeah, it's hard for us to do.
And you've spoken a little bit about how this changed your life in, you know, other compartments. Do you have any narratives like from guys who have done this? Like, what are their experiences through this?
Yeah, the guys in this practice, just generally speaking, change so radically. I love men, but they just change so radically through this process. To have it be that their hunger for being in the field of a woman in her sex isn't shamed or made wrong, right? To have it be that, like, that kind of conditioned thing that we're taught to do, like, yeah, to contract our sex in the face of male hunger, to have it be that that doesn't happen, right? That I start to take ownership and responsibility for my sex and, like, to start to play there, rather than, like, lock it down more. Like, I actually turn it up more to the point where, like, often our guys at first get a little full and they're like, okay, I gotta go, right? Just to be in the field of, like, a turn on woman, he's like giving approval and attention and, like, which isn't to say, like, necessarily, like, making out with or having sex with or whatever, but just, like, approval for their hunger to make them right there starts to shift them. And, like, and again, once they get the visceral somatic experience that that's available to them, like they can stroke, then that grabbiness that can sometimes be in there, which is like what happens when that hunger kind of turns, I don't want to say toxic, but like, you know, that grabbiness relaxes a little bit. And then he gets to learn how to play her pussy like a musical instrument. Like, then it's just play. And then we, you know, we start with scales, right? But then, like, you get to this masterful place where you can really just shred, you know? Lightly, of course. But, like, this whole range of things starts to open up. And then they start to feel more in their life. You know, this kind of stereotypical thing of, like, men are very analytical starts to melt away. The vulnerable stuff gets touched, the vulnerable stuff comes out, and the vulnerable stuff becomes their power. Yeah. So, you know, that sounds good, right? That's good.
It's like shredding on the vagine. Yeah.
I mean, like, watching a demo is like watching Hendrix sometimes, or like watching a symphony, or like, you know, what, depending on like what flavor the demo is, mm-hmm. but like, it has that kind of feeling of like, that bigness, mm-hmm. you know, where you're just, I mean, people faint. Most people, like, fall out of their chairs. People, like, it's, we tell people, like, put your feet on the floor, put your hands on your lap, buckle up, keep your arms and legs inside the car. Because that, you don't know how you're going to react to it, but something in there is going to shift. Like, something in there is going to get touched.
I want more of these kind of details. So you're sitting there, feet on the floor, hands on your lap. Tell me more. What else is going on?
And like, you're watching a live demonstration of orgasmic meditation. So this is part of our classes.
Oh, these are the people that are just sitting there. These aren't the people who are actually in
right.
practice. Okay.
And still, like, shit's potent.
Just know? Being in the presence of it?
Like, it's potent. It's people cry. People and sometimes people just, like, name physical sensation in their body. And, like, honestly, if they can do that, it's often for the first time, right? You ask somebody how they're feeling, they're going to respond with an emotional state, probably more often than not. They're not going to say, like, I feel an area expansion in my chest. That's not a thing that people say, right? So people are learning to find language for what's physically happening in their body. And, like, something very deep often is getting touched in simply watching one, right? And I think that speaks to that limbic thing. You know, I hear a lot from my students, like, God, I felt like I got stroked in that demo. Like, God, something, like, I don't know, this doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, you're right, it doesn't, and it's true. You know, like,
is there, like, ongoing research, like, are there peer-reviewed studies people can look at and find out, like,
we're not there yet, and we're getting there. NanWise, who's awesome. I love NanWise. Who's up at Rutgers because, you know, Newark's sexy.
Like, you know.
We were part of a research study there where she was starting to look at, she slid the strokey, basically. I mean, it wasn't a research on oming per se. It was a research on clitoral stimulation and the difference between self-stimulation and partnered stimulation and la, 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 and what orgasm looked like versus fake orgasm versus, like, you know, just pretending to touch your nipple or and actually touching. So all this stuff. And, you know, that's really where we are in the research, is like just beginning to map what the brain might be looking like in there and looking at what's common and what's not. And, you know, one of the things she pointed to, which I thought was really interesting, is, well, first, this surprised me. I don't know if I can geek out a little bit. The commonly held belief, why stop now? The commonly held belief is that other parts of the brain go silent during climax. And that's, she said that's not true. The limbic system does like beef up and light up, but so does the cortex. But the limbic system beefs up so much more. Like it's one of the few times when we can really map a significant brain event, she said. You know, and if you think about it, that's probably true. Like you can't... you know, slide the surfer in the barrel roll into an fMRI machine in that state, right? So you can start to get a map of like what we might call flow state in those moments. We're starting to look at some EEG research in terms of like starting to, I think we're a long way from having the data, but like starting to look at, you know, this idea of limbic resonance and is what's happening in his brain, what's happening in her brain, or what's happening in the stroker's brain. Like, and like you see that stuff light up on a graph and you can't say that that means the same thing to the stroker that it means to the strokee. So that's one of the problems with the research that we're starting to look at. But, you know, we are a big piece of like starting to unpack all this stuff. Like we're working with UCLA and like there's little like fertile grounds of research coming up. And I think it's so awesome just that we can become kind of assigned authors for that. Like we're a means by which you can start to map what's going on in orgasm, what's starting to go on in like flow state, you know, where like, you know, Tony Hawk is skateboarding through the thing and like, wah! Right? Like that thing where it all goes silent and all goes quiet is very similar to orgasm. And we can start to look at that and map that and begin to understand it more deeply.
Very cool. So people who... inspired by this conversation want to check this out, like where can they find out more about you, more about One Taste, like where shall we direct them?
OneTaste.us is the main website for One Taste kind of worldwide, and then from there you can start to see if there's locations near you. I mean, I know your podcast listeners are kind of from all over. We're very active in Europe, very active in North America, a very, very active, my girl be killing it down in Australia. She's amazing. She's a force. So very, very active down there. And, you know, there's little pockets of orgasm elsewhere in the world. You know, in there's Omers in South Africa. There's a couple in India. There's, you know, there's little pockets everywhere. But OneTaste.us will start to direct you towards that. And then often you can find kind of those introductory level, like, clothes on, you know, nothing too confronting. Like, but you can start to see if this is for you on Meetup in whatever your city is. We have regular meetups pretty much everywhere that we're active. So
there's for all levels of preparedness.
Yeah, totally. And like, we really want it to be that way. Like this week, I'm teaching a class on like an adjunct practice to that we call fear inventory. That's a way of like starting to make meaning out of this, some of the stuff that's coming up in orgasm. So you have a chance to like metabolize it and digest it. So yeah, we try to have it be that there's a lot of entry points and that the thing that you're hungry for, like you've got a route in if you want it.
And do you feel comfortable giving people contact information if they want to talk to you specifically?
Sure, totally. Katie.Brennan, KATI.BRENNAN at onetaste.us. And for One Taste Philly, the number is 917-361-9799.
Beautiful.
We've got a class coming up at the end of February if you're local. If you're not, you can find one.
Very cool. So thank you for this really fascinating introduction, because like this is wholly unlike anything else that I personally have knowledge of.
Paradigm shift. It really is.
Yeah.
So thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for coming. And thank you everyone for listening, and have a fantastic day. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timory. Sex with Timory, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimory.com, Sex with Timory on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timory_LEIGH.
If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.